Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red.
Today, we're starting an occasional roundtable series, and here's the idea behind it. I wanted to choose one book, one film, and one album. And then we'd invite three smart people into the studio for a discussion about that book, that movie, and that album. So today, we begin with the music. We've chosen Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks album, in part because it reached a milestone this year, 40 years since it came out, and in part because there's still a lot of debate about whether it's Dylan's best, what it's really about, and what four decades of hindsight reveals about the music on it. Our guests, including a musician who played on the album, have their views. I'm interested in yours, too. Do you remember the first time you heard Tangled Up in Blue or You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go? How does the album connect with your life, whether you were around when it first came out or whether you've come to it as a younger music lover? So think about your connection with Bob Dylan's album, Blood on the Tracks, and tweet me about your connection to it. Again, whether you heard it the first time it came out or whether you've come to it as a younger music lover. Tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Stephen Hyden is a staff writer for Grantland and author of Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. Sounds like a book I ought to read. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Greg Inhofer is with us. He's a Twin Cities-based singer, songwriter, and pianist, and he played the keyboard for Blood on the Tracks. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie.
Andrea Swenson is with us. She's a music reporter for 89.3 The Current and writes The Current's blog, and you can hear her on the air on Sunday evenings. It's a really good show, Andrea. Welcome.
Thanks
good to have
for
you
having
here.
Me.
So, Greg, you played keyboards on Blood on the Tracks. Does your name appear anywhere on the album? Do you get any credit for that?
Not originally. I have heard that on some compilation records we were given credit.
But it is not on the original album cover.
Well, it wasn't on the original, no.
And why?
They originally had 100,000 copies pressed of the jacket. And it said Eric Weisberg and Deliverance on the back because that's who had done the New York sessions. We were told when that was done, if those sold out, that we would be on the second pressing. And on the second pressing, I think Eric Weisberg and Deliverance was taken off and there was a picture, a portrait that Bob had painted
right
on it.
And your name never got there?
No.
Or the other fellow Minneapolis band members. I think we should explain what the story is. Stephen, do you know it?
It's my understanding that Dylan originally recorded the record in New York and also in Nashville, I believe, and wasn't completely satisfied with the versions that were done there. They were a little bit more stripped down and didn't quite have the essence that he was looking for. So then he ended up coming back home and recording with local musicians here. I believe he also wrote a lot of the songs when he was living here. So there might have been something about coming back home for him that made him feel like he wanted to record here as
Greg,
well.
Greg, when you got the call to do it, who called you and what did they say?
I was not told who. I was just told, do you want to do a session?
Really? You were told show up
at Sound 80, show up at this time.
What happened when you showed up?
We sat around for a minute and in walked Bob, and I think he had Jacob with him. One of the 2 days for sure.
And so then you realize, I'm going to be playing on this new album with right. Bob Dylan. What did he say to you about what the session was going to be like?
He had a cold, and he was a little aloof. You know, he kept to himself, you know. He talked when he needed to. He wasn't unfriendly, but he wasn't, you know, glad-handing everybody either, you know.
Right. How much direction, though, was he giving you about what he wanted? Because, again, these songs have been recorded in New York, and they were changing them up.
We hadn't heard the sessions from New York.
Would it have mattered, do you think, if you had?
I don't know. It may have changed. It may have changed some things. I'm not certain.
Andrea, what's the mythology that you've heard around this?
Well, I know from a historical standpoint, it really legitimized that studio, Sound 80. All of a sudden, people were saying, whoa, Bob Dylan recorded there. It was a short-lived studio, but the people involved with it went on to have a huge impact on the local scene. And of course, these players have been such a part of the community that I think there's a mythology around all of them that they even got to be in that room and be part of that recording and be part of, you know, this story that lives on.
Do you feel that, Greg, that it was in some ways a turning point for your career?
Which direction?
You tell me. That's kind of the interesting part of this.
I had just come off of working with Olivia Newton-John on the road for 2 years.
Yeah.
And had we have gotten credit, there could have been a whole lot different path for me.
Like what?
Well, John Farrar is Olivia's producer, and he always said, once you have a hit, everybody wants to recreate it. They want to use the same studio, the same musicians. They want to know what kind of drugs there were, where they came from.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The same everything. They want to recreate it. And we could have gotten some work out of it, you know. Somebody could have been touring and said, hey, let's get that whole Bob Dylan Blood on the Tracks band and take them on the road.
Right.
You know, but at the same time, all roads lead to now, and I'm pretty happy.
You don't spend a lot of time saying what if.
No.
Some, though.
Not anymore.
Some.
I have, yeah.
You know, Stephen, it's interesting to hear Greg say that. I didn't know that about the music industry, that if there's a hit, people in the industry are saying, do it all like that again, only make it sound different, because there was some kind of magic around that. That kind of surprises me.
Yeah, I mean, well, especially with someone like Dylan, even people that are, you know, session musicians that play on his records, a lot of them have become famous for that. You know, like Kenry Buttery was a well-known session drummer in Nashville, and he played on a lot of the records that Dylan recorded in the 60s. You know, he was the drummer on John Wesley Harding and Blonde on Blonde. And, and Charlie McCoy, another guy, played bass. You know, people obsess over these records. They read the liner notes, and they memorize everything about them. So, you know, even those people become stars in a way among fans.
Andrew, do you think that still happens in the music business?
What are liner notes? No, yeah. Just kidding.
That's right.
It's not as easily accessible to have that much information about the recordings. And I imagine that there's situations today where someone like Greg is on a recording and a fan might have no way of knowing that.
Right. Right. Well, a fan didn't have any way of knowing he was on the Blood on the Tracks recording it. When did it start to come out, Greg?
As far as?
That people became aware that you'd been involved in this.
There was an immediate, you know, random notes in Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
There was a blurb in random notes right after it came out.
And then?
Listed all the musicians' names.
Okay. And then kind of nothing.
Yeah.
So will you choose a song from the album that we can really hear the keyboards and that you can talk us through what it was like to record it? Which one would you choose?
They're very simple. I mean, when we recorded it, I was in a band that was doing original material, and our cover material was McLaughlin and Weather Report and Chick Corea.
Yeah.
So musically, it had nothing to offer for me. And I'm not saying...
Wow, that's really interesting to hear you say that.
Well, I'm not saying it was boring. I like doing every session I do, and I try to do the best I can on every session I do. But it wasn't like it was musically challenging or exciting or new. They're very simple musically. Lyrically, he's very, you know, deep and layered and incredible.
But the actual melodies, the music, what do you guys think? You think that's true?
Well, I can definitely see, you know, I could see that from the point of view of a musician, especially if you're an accomplished musician, that these would be easy songs to play. I mean, as a listener, the powerful thing about Bob Dylan is that there's an elemental aspect of his music that feels like it's been around forever. And obviously he was drawing from a folk tradition, so that was very deliberate on his part. But, you know, there is something about the juxtaposition between the words, which are very dense, and the music, which is very clear and simple, that I think it's a very powerful combination. I think it really connects with people if you are a Dylan fan.
You know, I've never heard anybody put it quite like that, that there is this sense that the music has always been there, but that's true.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so powerful. You know, he was able to connect with this sort of continuum of music that places him in this larger context, you know, and it's always been, I think, a big part of what people love about him, that, you know, he was new at a time, but it was also something that seemed like it was always there.
Andrew, do you hear that?
I agree with the simplicity part, but I do think that there is a skill to creating the textures and the moods that come across in his music. And even if it's not technically very complicated, I do think that one thing that resonates with me when I listen to that album is that you're picking up on these amazing textures and you kind of feel like you're in the room. And that is, well, it's not, you know, ripping scales. I think there is a skill to that, too. And I think that's a testament to the players.
By textures, what do you mean?
Like, the, you know, the way the organ is mixed or the combination of instruments and the way it, you know, goes with his voice. I think that throughout his career, he's been really good at creating kind of a vibe.
But he has never done that alone. It's always
right.
with a producer who's going, Bob, I think we should do this. And then he will say, you know, I'd like to hear the vocal do more there. Or whatever he'll say, you know.
I think there's something, too, about how the songs were recorded. Like, I was talking to you before we started taping about how, you know, he had the chords on a newspaper and ripped it out and put it on your organ. And you guys maybe ran through the songs a couple of times before actually recording them. And I think that's part of what makes Dylan Records great, at least for me, is the sense of spontaneity, you know, because, you know, these songs are obviously very composed lyrically, but it sounds like he's talking to you, like mm-hmm. that he's just sort of expressing what's going on in his life, especially on this record, which is such a personal record. And, you know, it's probably the greatest breakup album of all time. I can't think of a better, like, sort of romantic turmoil record. It's certainly the album that, like, when I've gone through horrible breakups in my life, this is the record I turn to. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I'm married now, so hopefully I'm done with romantic breakups. But yeah, I mean, because he's articulating things that you feel in your own heart, but he does it way better than you could ever do it.
Like, which again makes that sense of spontaneity surprising, right? Because you know he labored over, I would assume, every phrase, maybe every word. It never sounds like that.
Yeah,
right?
And the performances on the record, I mean, they sound like they're alive, you know, that they haven't been totally crafted and made perfect, that these, you know, that he was just sort of expressing what was in the moment and they're capturing a moment, not necessarily the perfect recording of that song. And that's how he's always approached his songs. You know, they always evolve in concert and,
Greg?
And all that.
When I listen to these same songs on YouTube or something, concerts that he's done after the fact, lyrics change. Phrases change, you know, it's a constant work of, you know, I believe 3 was the amount of takes that he would do on a song.
Because?
For the reason that Steve said, the spontaneity, it starts to settle in. You start to do things because you did them last time, rather than looking over the horizon.
So how do musicians, session musicians, feel about that? Because are you there to be technically as good as you can be, or are you there to, I don't know, take your cue? Yeah.
I learned one of the greatest lessons of my life during these sessions that I carried with me and still carry today. We had just recorded Rosemary and Jack of Hearts, and the drum track is, you know, trains. Doop-a-dap-a-doop-a-dap-a-doop-a-dap-a-doop-a-dap. And Bill Berg is I had such respect for him as a very accomplished jazz musician in town. And he was over in the corner listening with Bob. And he's telling Bob, he's saying, now I can either do it doop-a-dap-a-doop-a-dap, or I could do dap-a-doop-a-dap-a-doop-a-dap. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, here's this giant reservoir of talent. And he's handing the spigot to Bob. Turn on as much or as little as you want.
Yeah.
And I would rather do a session and have people say, what a great session, rather than what a crappy session, but boy, listen to that keyboard player, you know? Changed my view for life.
Let's listen to the song. Here it is.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cabaret was quiet, except for the drilling in the wall. The curtain had been lifted and the
left town, he was standing in the doorway, looking like the Jack of Hearts. He moved across the mirrored room, set it up for everyone, he said. Then everyone commenced to do what they were doing before he turned their heads. Then he walked up to a stranger and he asked him with a grin, could you kindly tell me, friend, what time the show begins? Then he moved into the corner, face down like the Jack of Hearts.
So that's music from Bob Dylan's album, Blood on the Tracks, and it's the subject of our roundtable today. We're starting a new occasional series where we're going to talk about a single album, a single film, a single book, and we've gathered what I always call three smart people into the studio to help me do that today. Stephen Hayden is with us. He's a staff writer for Grantland. Greg Inhofer is here, Twin Cities based singer, songwriter, and pianist, and he played keyboards for Blood on the Tracks and that song that you just heard. And Andrea Swenson is a music reporter for 89.3 The Current. So, Greg, what do you hear now as you listen to that 40 years after you did it?
Wow.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Well, I don't think I've ever walked out of a session not thinking, oh, I should have. Oh, I could have.
Really?
Yeah.
And so are you saying that as you hear that, you think there's that spot that I could have, should have?
I would do it differently now.
You would?
Probably.
How would you do it differently?
I'm not sure. I would probably turn that Leslie on at least once.
What would that have added to it?
Another dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just love that you played on like one of the greatest albums of all time and you're like, I didn't quite nail it.
I know. You know?
I don't know when it was. I was sitting in my apartment once and I had a stack of bills on my coffee table that I was wondering how I was going to pay. And I'm watching MTV, back when MTV actually had music.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember that.
And they were playing the top 100 albums of all time. And number 25, Blood on the Tracks. And I'm listening to Tangled Up in Blue. And I'm just wondering about the irony of it all. What if?
What if?
Yeah.
What if I'd had the credit?
What
for
if
being part of Tangled Up in Blue?
What if I could have paid these bills? You know,
right? Let's listen to Tangled Up in Blue. Tell us a little bit about the experience of playing that. What you remember, and then I'll ask these guys about what they hear in it.
It was originally lower; the key was lower, and a Kevin Odegaard, who was one of the players on the session, suggested to Bob, you know, after we ran it down in the key of G, he suggested that he play it in A. You know, it's like, wow, he's telling Bob Dylan he should change the key of his song.
How'd Bob take it?
He took it fine, and he did it fine. You know, he liked it. It was higher for him vocally.
Let's listen.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they set our lives together. Sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress. Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night, both agreeing it was best. And she turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue.
Okay, now I'm just trying to imagine what that would have sounded like lower. I can't because this version is in my head. Andrea, can you?
No. No, I can't. I just find myself getting so lost in that song. I have to come back down a little bit.
I know. Steven?
Yeah, the thing that blows me away about that song, you know, it's obviously the first song on the record, so it sets the tone for what you're going to listen to. He just sounds so grown up on this album. I mean, he was like in his mid-30s when he made this record. He had already been making records for like, you know, 14, 15 years at that point. And, you know, that song, it's a journey. It's about, like, that song is about a life. I think he had a line, there's some quote that he said that, you know, it took him, you know, 30 years to write that song because he had to live that much life in order to get to that song. And, you know, just the idea of, like rock and roll at that time being considered strictly youth music, and yet this was clearly an adult record with adult themes, and it's about a guy who's like had some experiences, some good, some bad, and now he's gonna try to, you know, decompress from all of it.
You know, I feel like I hear a certain amount of weary maturity, right, that you can't have at 20, right? You can fake it, but it does not sound genuine.
Absolutely. I think that's why I tend to respond to it on more of an emotional level, because you can totally relate to that experience. These characters coming in and out of each other's lives and always wondering what could have been. It just perfectly captures that kind of nostalgia and that ache for something that might not ever happen.
It does. Does it matter what it's about? Because as you all know, Dylan has said some pretty different things about what it's about. I mean, initially, I think he was doing an interview with Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary. This is in 1975. And he said, a lot of people tell me they enjoyed that album. It's hard for me to relate to that. I mean, people enjoying that kind of pain. But as the years go on, he pulls back from the idea that it's the coming end of his marriage. Does it matter what it's about?
Yeah, I mean, I always think that's funny when Dylan denies that these songs are autobiographical. You know, and that's a very Dylan-esque thing to do. I mean, I think with all songs, all that matters is what you as a listener bring to it. You know,
I think so.
I think even an artist would say that. I think a lot of artists usually they don't want to talk about what their songs are about because they want the listener to make it about their own lives, not necessarily like what the singer-songwriter was going through. And I think maybe that's why Dylan says that they're not autobiographical, that he's maybe trying to deflect from his own life and make people think about themselves. I mean, I know for me, the reason I love that record isn't because Dylan was going through a divorce. It's because when I listen to it, it makes me think about my own life.
And but you know that. And so, I mean, you said
it's the first
album I turned to when I went through a breakup. And part of the reason is that because you can't unknow that Dylan experienced that too, right?
But it's there in the songs. You know, you can hear that if you heard that album in a vacuum, I think that the pain in those songs is pretty apparent, and that's what makes it so powerful. I mean, as a Dylan fan, yeah, I want to know about his personal life, and I'm curious about how the album was created and all that stuff. But as a listener, I don't think that you have to love the album. That you have to know that stuff in order to love the album. I think the material that you need is all there.
Greg, what do you think?
I think if somebody heard Tangled Up in Blue on the radio, which was the first single he had in years, they wouldn't necessarily think that it was about him breaking up with his wife if they didn't know, and they would enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
As a songwriter, it's like the song comes from a particular moment, but that doesn't mean that it's everyone's moment. You know, everyone can interpret it as long as they're interpreting it, you know, somehow positively.
You mean in the session?
No, I mean any song that you put out there,
you
know, whether you recorded it or you're playing it live. You know,
and yet,
whatever they get out of it.
But, you know, my theory, though, is we can hear the ferociousness in some of the music. Idiot Wind, which we'll play a little bit later. We can hear the pain in some of this. Would it have resonated the way it does if it hadn't come out of that place?
Well, I think it's partly where that album ended up in the arc of his career, because, you know, in the early 70s, there was a period where he wasn't really making much music.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came back and did the tour with the band, which was sort of like one of the first big like arena rock tours in 1974. But that was basically a greatest hits tour. And then he did Planet Ways with the band, which is a really good record, but not quite as much of a comeback. And then Blood on the Tracks really kind of reestablished Bob Dylan as like a major force. And if you look at his career, he's kind of had that throughout his career, where he'll have peaks and then there's valleys and then he'll have a comeback and then there's more valley and then there's another peak. He's had like three or four of those in his career. But Blood on the Tracks was the first. And I think what makes it so great, along with that backstory, is that it was a new Bob Dylan, that he wasn't just trying to be what he was in the early 60s, that he was a grown-up, he was singing about grown-up stuff. And I think that the lyrics on that record are probably the greatest of his career. They're certainly the most sophisticated, I think, in terms of, and also just the most, you know, there's a lot of talk about Dylan always writing in code, mm-hmm. and being dense, and there's that on that record. But for me, there's just so many things that he says on that record that I think are so true about the human heart and relationships. I really think that just in terms of art, it's like one of the best pieces of art about human relationships ever made.
I want to know what Greg thinks of this. Those are some pretty elaborate statements there, Greg. Do you believe it? You think that's true?
Oh, boy. Again, if that's how Stephen perceives it, that's great.
Mission accomplished.
It may or may not have been exactly what Bob had in mind when he, only Bob knows that, you know. What he was specifically writing about at that song. Or,
yeah, but I mean, we hear Stephen say it doesn't even matter that much because the finished product is this exceptional, the best piece of songwriting art? No,
I mean, I think it's his best. I would say
his best lyrics.
I think it's his best lyrics. I think that these songs are so good that, like Shelter from the Storm is a song that it's about the arc of a relationship. It's about meeting someone, feeling that they are your savior in a way. Mm-hmm. And then over time, drifting apart from them and bidding them farewell. You know, he does that over the course of about 5 minutes. And yeah, he was drawing on his own experiences. But like, if you listen to that song and you've ever been in love with someone and then broken up with them, I think it speaks to that experience.
Let's listen to it. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable that launches an occasional series that we're doing about discussions around one book, one film, one album. Today we're talking about Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. We're listening to the music. We've gathered a group of three smart people in the studio to talk about the album. And we'll continue to listen to more music and talk about it here after we get a look at the latest news.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm John Wanamaker. Forecasters are saying a hurricane headed for Mexico's Pacific coast could be catastrophically destructive. Hurricane Patricia has winds over 200 miles per hour. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says it's the strongest hurricane ever in the Western Hemisphere. It's expected to come ashore later today. Texas could see another round of heavy rain after Patricia makes landfall in Mexico and moves northeast. Forecasters say parts of Texas could see 5 to 8 inches of rain with isolated pockets of up to a foot. Flash flood watches have been posted for the Texas Hill Country and along Interstate 35 from the Austin-San Antonio area to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq has identified the commando killed in a raid against the Islamic State group in northern Iraq. He is Master Sergeant Joshua Wheeler. The 39-year-old Oklahoma native was assigned to the U.S. Army Special Operations Command in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. The Defense Department says he was shot yesterday as U.S. and Iraqi forces raided a compound near Kirkuk and freed about 70 Iraqi prisoners. Lincoln Chafee is the latest candidate to end his campaign for the White House. The announcement by the former Rhode Island governor leaves three main contenders in the Democratic race, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley. Former Virginia Senator Jim Webb has also announced he's dropping out, and Vice President Joe Biden has decided against running for president. Now, looking at Wall Street, it's a busy day. Stocks sharply higher in early trading on Wall Street. Technology shares leading the way after several big-name companies reported big earnings gains. Microsoft, Amazon, and Google's parent company, Alphabet, all reported surprisingly strong results since yesterday. The NASDAQ was up nearly 2%, up 1.91% right now. The Dow up 0.71%. The S&P up nearly 1%. Also keeping an eye on 3M stock. That stock finished up over 4% yesterday after the company trimmed its profit forecast and announced layoffs of around 1,500. But that stock now down 5.5%. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Later on All Things Considered, all the news from wherever it happens. And since it's Friday, we'll eavesdrop on Stephanie Curtis and Ewan Kerr as they set the silver screen agenda. I'm Tom Cran. Cube critics and the news join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. 'Twas then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable, and we're playing Bob Dylan because we are contemplating the 40th anniversary of the release of Blood on the Tracks. It's part of an occasional series here we're doing for the Friday Roundtable. In the studio with me to talk about the album, Andrea Swenson from 89.3 The Current, Greg Inhofer, Twin Cities musician who played on Blood on the Tracks, and Steve Hyden, staff writer for Grantland. This is interesting. When I went back to read about what happened when the album came out, Rolling Stone's reviewer John Landau, who would, I guess, end up managing Bruce Springsteen's band, said the album lacked permanence and he didn't think it would stand the test of time. I mean, and then I started thinking about that. I thought, well, okay, if we didn't have the historical... And I'll direct this to you, Andrea, since you probably weren't even born when the album... No, you weren't born
That's
when the album
true.
Came out. So if we didn't have the historical context of it, how would we view the album, do you think?
You mean like if it just came out today and...
Yes.
I think that, as Stephen said before, there's something timeless about it. And I think that there are plenty of talented songwriters that are still making music that sounds like this, and I think it would stand above most of those songwriters.
You do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it would get a very high score on Pitchfork.
Did you say that there are songwriters that sound like this, right?
Yes, yeah.
That he's clearly influenced.
Oh, absolutely.
And yet they don't reach what I think you're saying is the uniqueness of what you hear in Blood on the Tracks.
Yeah, the interesting thing about hearing people try to sound like Dylan or try to capture Dylan is I think some people go about it trying to capture maybe the tone or the textures or the mood of his music. Some people go for the lyrical content. And few people are able to do both. Capture the emotion behind the words and words that actually mean something and resonate with people and are clever and keep you guessing and keep you thinking about it. I mean, one reason that this album stands up is that when I listen to it, I hear a different lyric every time that pops out at me and go, oh, you know, that line about how people don't know how to act around him. That's so literal. And you're thinking about what it must have been like to be in his role and be that level of celebrity in that time. And you just keep wondering about what he's thinking and what you're going to hear next.
That is a great point, that the phrasing seems new, not just the way he's delivering the phrasing, but the phrasing itself seems new. How does that happen? How does that? You're a songwriter, Greg. How does that happen? How rare is that?
Frank Sinatra,
yeah,
had phrasing. Dylan's got phrasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he can change it, you know, live, and it still holds up. I mean, a good song is a good song.
Yeah,
he's got interesting phrasing. In 2000, we did a Blood on the Tracks 25th anniversary show at Pantages and brought in all the players who played on the Minneapolis sessions. And Eric Weisberg from Deliverance was there, and some other people. And it was amazing to me how it was huge. I mean, we all sang the different songs. I sang a couple. Adam Levy sang Idiot Wind. Different people. With Kevin Odegaard sang Simple Twist of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to do.
How relevant, how...
Yeah.
Permanent. Sorry, yeah. John Landau, but how permanent the music scene.
That was 25 years old. Now another 15.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, when you read that John Landau quote, it actually made me think of when Lester Bangs wrote about that record. He said that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, this album didn't teach me anything about women. It was just a crying towel. And I want more than a crying towel. And I remember reading that and thinking, no, that's exactly what I want from a record, you know? Because, you know, I think the reason why critics reacted that way is that there was so much baggage with Bob Dylan at that time.
Yeah.
I think people expected him to give them the answers to everything. You know, that's how he was perceived in the 60s as this, not just as a musician, but as a cultural leader. And of course, he rejected that and escaped it. But even I think at that time, people still expected him to make these sort of overtly profound statements. When in reality, he was a poet, you know, and he was a guy writing. You know, he was creating poetry, and that's what this record is. It's something much more personal. So you know, maybe the idea was that like, well, he's just writing love songs. This is not. The
what
important
we expect,
things. These are ephemeral love
right.
songs. These aren't, and you know, I mean, I've written reviews. I write album reviews. So I know what it's like to say something and then 6 months later look like a fool. I'm not going to be.
How does that feel, by
yeah,
the way?
You know, so you don't know. I mean, John Landau had no way of knowing what people think of Blood on the Tracks 40 years later. But,
right.
you know, I also wanted to, you know, follow up on the phrasing thing, you know. Because I think that's a really great point. I mean, people make fun of Bob Dylan's vocals all the time. You know, they sound weird, or especially now, they're like all over the place.
The quality of his voice,
right.
tone of it, yeah.
It's not for everybody, but I
right.
think, you know, the phrasing is arguably as important as the songs
yeah.
because, you know, you talk about Sinatra. Sinatra didn't write his own songs,
right.
but when he sings It Was a Very Good Year, you feel like he's talking about his own life.
Right.
Because he had a way of singing that sounded like he was talking to you. And Dylan has the same thing. He is writing his own songs, but they wouldn't come off as well if he didn't sing them the way he did. Like, you really feel like he's communicating something from inside his own heart to you, the listener, and only to you, the listener. You know, it feels like a one-to-one transaction when you listen to his records.
That is something that is so rare. And I was actually talking about this with a novelist earlier this week, about that communion that the writer, songwriter, painter can have with an individual, and how it is a higher quality of communication, of communion. And it doesn't happen very often, but it is the thing about art that is extraordinary, right?
Yeah, I mean, people feel like they know Bob Dylan.
Right.
And that's Bob Dylan's curse, because he can't go anywhere without running into these crazy people that feel, it's like, hey, Bob, you understand me better than anyone in my own life. And it's like, well, and he, you know, the poor guy, you know, he's just writing songs. But that's how we feel as the audience listening to this music.
You brought up a song called Up to Me that didn't make Blood on the Track. So this was not part of the session, Greg, or it was?
Never heard
You didn't
it.
Play on that. Okay. What's the story?
I mean, I don't know a ton about the backstory. I mean, I think it was recorded in New York, but it's this amazing song that didn't make Blood on the Tracks. And Bob Dylan is notorious for this, for recording incredible tunes that don't make the record, and then like 20, 30 years later, they come out in box sets and all that stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's listen to a little bit of it and then tell us what else you know about it.
What others were thinking, the heart inside me would have died, but I was just too stubborn to ever be governed by enforced insanity. Someone had to reach for the rising star, I guess it was up to me. Now the Union Central is pulling out, the orchids are in bloom. I've only got me one good shirt left, and it smells of stale perfume. In
14 months, I've only smiled once, and I didn't do it consciously. Somebody's got to find your trail. I guess it's gonna be up to me.
I think that's really beautiful, and there's a lot of really beautiful imagery.
Yeah, and the song ends with Dylan talking directly about himself, where he talks about how there's like, you know, I've got the harmonica around my neck, I'm playing this guitar, and, you know, no one could move you like I can move you, is basically what he says at the end of the song. When I hear that song, I love Buckets of Rain. Buckets of Rain is the last song on Blood on the Tracks, but I feel like Up to Me would have been the ultimate, like, ending of that album, because it's similar to Tangled Up in Blue. It's another song, it's a journey, it's about sort of the beginning, middle, and end of a relationship, but it just caps that, it would have capped that album so well. But, you know, I'm not gonna find fault with Blood on the Tracks. I do feel, though, Up to Me should have been on that record.
Yeah, I mean, and you started to say that he was notorious for recording music that would then get tossed out for no apparent reason. Is that kind of the...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think one of the more famous examples of that is there's a song called Blind Willie McTell that he wrote in the early 80s, which is like this incredible song, one of the greatest songs that he certainly wrote during that period. And it didn't end up on the album. It was released, I think, like 20 years later as part of that bootleg series box set. And if you listen to that song and you listen to the songs that made albums at that time, you're just like, what are you thinking?
Made his albums or any albums?
His albums, yeah. Because the albums that he was doing at that time, you know, they have their merits, but they weren't like his best work. But like that song is like an all-time great Bob Dylan song, and he didn't put it on the record. And it almost seems like perverse that he would do that, almost like he's punishing his own listeners for, you know, like, I'm going to withhold my best stuff from you for whatever reason.
And that'll teach you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, right? You know, he's a mercurial guy, so who knows what his justification for that was.
There is a Salon piece by a music critic who argues that Dylan really invented the concept of singer-songwriter. Greg, you're a singer-songwriter. Do you think he is the guy that kind of showed the way to people like you and everybody that's come after?
Not when there's Woody Guthrie and people like that, Howlin' Wolf, or Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm. You know,
not when there's people like that before him that sang and played. To me, a singer-songwriter is usually anybody who can play an instrument and sing a song and get the message across by themselves.
But that's the key. The last part of what you just said
by
is the key.
Well,
get the message across.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Taylor Swift is a singer-songwriter. She can go up with her guitar and play her songs and get the message across.
I don't think of her. Why don't I think of her as a singer-songwriter, though?
Because you've been told she's a pop artist.
That's right.
I mean, I don't buy her CDs or anything.
Right.
But, you know.
But yeah, I mean, she writes songs about her own life.
Yeah.
Right,
and
she does.
You know, so
I should think of her like
she's
that.
She's definitely cut from that cloth. I mean, you know, I don't think Dylan invented that, but I think that the culture
anointed him,
or like he sort of codified what a singer-songwriter is supposed to be, like in the popular consciousness. I don't think Dylan ever set out to like say, "I am the foremost singer-songwriter. I've invented this, and you know, you're all following me." I think that's something that we've all put on him. But I think certainly when you think of a singer-songwriter, you think of one person on stage playing an acoustic guitar,
right?
Often with a harmonica around their neck. You know, Woody Guthrie did that too. But more people know Bob Dylan than they know Woody Guthrie. So he, for that reason, becomes the reference point, I think.
So do you think, Andrea, we kind of need to change up our image of... Because when I think of singer-songwriter, I have to say, I do go back to the tradition that I think follows mm-hmm. Bob Dylan.
I mean, I think that goes all the way back to, like they were saying, the folk tradition and the traveling troubadours. And I think from an industry standpoint, he established that you could play folk music and be on the radio.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think that singer-songwriter as a genre has kind of almost turned into a way to sideline certain artists. And
has it?
Yeah, especially women, you know. Oh, if it's a woman with a guitar, she's a singer-songwriter, but if it's a guy, he's a rock artist. It's interesting to me what that does to our, you know, preconceptions about what we're listening to.
Stephen, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. It's also interesting to remember that there's a lot of like huge pop stars who are singer-songwriters that aren't described that way. Like
right.
Adele is a singer-songwriter.
Yes, that's true.
You know, Taylor Swift is a singer-songwriter. Like Beyonce is a singer-songwriter. You know, she writes her songs and she sings them. So she's a singer-songwriter. I mean, you know, going back to Dylan, I just, you know, there's this sort of cult of personality
yes.
that goes around singer-songwriters, this idea that like you are talking about your own life, that's a big part of your art. There's also this sort of idea, I think, especially in the 60s and 70s, that you were like a truth teller, you know, that
yeah.
you had
that you're, truth. Exactly what I was thinking. You're channeling some kind of higher truth that the rest of us need to know.
So nobody thinks of Billy Joel as a singer-songwriter with a piano.
But we should. Yeah.
I love this story about like when Bob Dylan, like in the early 70s, when he wasn't really recording a lot of music, he heard that song Heart of Gold by Neil Young mm-hmm. on the radio, and like he thought it was him. When first time he heard it, he's like, is that me? Did I record?
What?
I guess this speaks to maybe
Can
Bob
really
Dylan being
be true?
Well, yeah, because you know, cause you think, again, Neil Young being another sort of like, you know, core singer-songwriter, but he was obviously following Bob Dylan's example as a guy that would, you know, play guitar with a harmonica around his neck.
When was this?
This was like in the early 70s, like when Heart of Gold was like the number one song
yeah.
in America.
Okay.
There's this anecdote about him.
Okay.
So, you know.
Why do you say it like that, Greg?
No, middle of the 70s. I mean, that would have been, wasn't that some confusion days?
Yeah.
What do you just
I mean, it was
say?
For me.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe. And,
maybe
you
I'm
know.
Projecting.
Yeah,
Bob might
you
have been
are.
Joking a little bit there, too, but I always thought that was a funny thing.
I
that,
know.
You know, that he, and Bob Dylan's played that song. He's covered Heart of Gold. When I saw Bob Dylan, actually, in 2002, he played that song.
He doesn't cover a lot of other music, does he?
He does.
He does more than I think.
Yeah, he does. Like, again, this when I saw him in Berkeley in 2002, and he was playing with a great band at that time, with Larry Campbell and I can't remember the other guitar player's name, but it was a great band. And he was actually playing a bunch of Warren Zevon songs at that time, because Warren Zevon was dying in that period. So he played two Warren Zevon songs. He played, I think he played Heart of Gold, and he played Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones. So it seems like with Dylan, the only rule is that there's no rules. Like, he's just going to play whatever when he goes out there. But yeah, he'll do random covers sometimes.
What song do you guys think we ought to close with? What would be your, I mean, should we close with the song that ends the album, or should we close with something else? What would you say?
Have we played Shelter from the Storm yet?
I don't think we have we?
I think we need to have a good cry to it.
That's...
All right, let's listen to a little bit of Shelter from the Storm. Here it is.
'Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel-eyed death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Okay, I have to say that I absolutely hear that timelessness that you guys were talking about. And I don't know why in that song, but I think that's really exemplifies what we started out talking about.
Yeah, I had that song in my wedding.
Did
you? That was one of the readings, yeah, the lyrics mm-hmm. from that song. Aww. Not the end part where it gets sad and where they break up, just the happy part about how, you know, I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form.
Bob might be shocked that you actually decided to use that in your wedding, right?
Maybe. Well,
did
you know,
hear the last part of it?
Yeah, we just kind of edited that part out. So it's just this sweet, you know, pledging of devotion.
I had Dylan in my wedding too.
Did you?
Yeah, my dad read the lyrics to Forever Young.
That's nice. Yeah. As a poem, basically. Greg, what do you hear in that song?
I hear, I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He's a local guy. He's a country western guy. And he did that song at the Pantages show in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And for the life of me, I can't remember his name right now. He did a Johnny Cash thing for, hello, I'm not Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
And for the life of me, I can't recall his name.
But you think of him.
I think of him because he did such a heartfelt version of it live. You know, it was like, whoa, wow. Didn't know you had it in you.
This is the one that makes you cry, huh, Stephen?
Well, this one, and If You See Her, Say Hello.
Oh, yeah. We haven't played that yet. That's the song. Well,
yeah.
You ready for that?
You can't play that song.
We have to play that song.
There will be tears jerked out of my face immediately.
We have to close with that song. You guys, this has been great. Thank you so much for listening to the music with us and sharing your impressions of it. Stephen, Andrea, Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we will go out on If You See Her, Say Hello.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier. She left here last early spring. Is living there, I hear. Say for me that I'm all right. Though things get kind of slow, she might think that I've forgotten her. Don't tell her it isn't so.
Our show is produced by Markita Fornoff, Maddie Mahon, and Jeff Jones. Sam Chu directs the show. Our online team is Stephanie Curtis, Michael Olson, and Tracy Mumford. You can hear our programs anytime by subscribing to the podcast. Search for NPR News with Carrie Miller in your favorite podcast app or go to nprnews.org/podcasts.
And though our separation it pierced me to the heart, she still lives inside of me. We've never been apart. If you get close to her, kiss her once for me. Always have respected her for doing what she did.